From KCRW in Los Angeles and PRI, Left, Right, and Center presents 1 year later.
1 year later.
Can you believe it's 1 year later?
1 year later.
1 year later.
This land is your land. This land is my land.
Hi, I'm Ruben Navarrete, one of your hosts for the special series 1 year later, presented by Left, Right, and Center. It's the Trump era, and we're taking a new approach to political debate. A year after Donald Trump won over the masses, a debate over elitism continues. Some maintain that Trump was elected because many Americans are sick and tired of being talked down to by smug, condescending elitists. Others claim that what put Trump in office is something even more dangerous, a growing skepticism of expertise that has left ordinary people convinced that they know more than they really do. Which is it? We'll sort it all out. That's coming up next on 1 year later, after headlines from NPR.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24, or you can listen on KCRW's app.
We're back with 1 year later, presented by Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Ruben Navarrete, syndicated columnist and host of the podcast, Navarrete Nation. We've been hearing a lot about McDonald's lately, and not all of it is about President Trump's eating habits. Some say the fast food giant is also a place that reflects and unites American communities. Joining me on the line is author and longtime Chicago reporter Patrick Reardon, who just wrote about his affection for McDonald's. Hi, Patrick. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. It's good to be with you.
Well, this segment, Patrick, is guaranteed to make me hungry. I understand that you go to McDonald's every day, right? What inspired you to write about the fast food restaurant?
Well, I go to McDonald's for breakfast every morning, the oatmeal, and because I get bored at one place, I go to one of five different places within a mile of me. This is Chicago, so there's lots of places. And what I noticed, if you go to McDonald's very much, you start seeing the people there, and there's these communities. I'm not so much affectionate to McDonald's as to the communities that form in McDonald's. And it's like one place, it's a place where homeless people gather in the morning after spending a night out in the street. Another place, it's where these real tough-looking worker Hispanic guys, Mexican guys, I'm sure, come and gather. And then other places, it's city workers. Another place, it's developmentally disabled people. You know, it's... Each McDonald's kind of has a character to itself, even though they all look alike. And it's there's something about it that says something about America. Part of it is the openness. Everybody goes to McDonald's, as the news shows. Even the president goes to McDonald's.
So you have this great line in your piece about how, and you just mentioned it, how McDonald's, there's a fabric of diversity and the art of community. And there's all these, you say, low-key interactions that add up to something that's rich and democratic and fruitful. Explain what you meant by that.
Well, if you've got people working in McDonald's, it's their office, you know, and so you've got guys in suits, you know, sitting next to a homeless guy who's kind of fallen asleep, you know, because this is a warm place. And then next to him is this family, you know, this father and mother and three kids, and the father is a worker somewhere where he doesn't get a lot of respect, but the kids are just looking up to him as this great guy. And we're all together. In fact, the new cardinal that came to Chicago a few years ago, I wrote an open letter to him that ran in a couple places. And I started off with, you know, when you come to Chicago, go to the Burger King at this certain address and just sit there and you'll watch Chicago walk past you. Well, it's the same thing in any fast food place, basically. You're seeing America walk past you. And it's not the exclusivity of a lot of places. It's this... everybody likes McDonald's, and those who say they don't either, you know, are denying what they like, or they're pretending that they're better than everyone else. And if you wanna know America, you should just sit in McDonald's for a day and just watch who comes in and who goes out and what they talk about.
Now, obviously, not everybody loves McDonald's. Are you surprised that the place stirs such emotions with such people, with people like that? I bet you've had a strong reaction to your piece.
Well, it's I get these foodies, you know, saying, well, no, like when I wrote about the Cardinal, don't bring the Cardinal to
right.
Burger King. Oh, you can't do that. You have to bring him to this place.
Right.
And it's like those places are so elite. So, you know, I mean, the beauty of McDonald's is anybody can walk in there. In fact, I'm often standing in line behind some guy who is saying, well, how much would this be if I take that off and put this on? Because the guy only has $3, and he's wanting to get the most for his money. You know, it's the beauty of McDonald's is that it really is democratic. Everybody can walk in, whereas you get a fancy restaurant, and, you know, you can't walk in there.
Yeah, it's interesting. That was Chicago writer Patrick Reardon. Thank you so much for joining us, Patrick.
You're welcome.
Now I'm joined by two guests. Tom Nichols, a professor at the Naval War College and author of the book, The Death of Expertise, The Campaign Against Established Knowledge and Why It Matters. And Joan Williams, professor at the University of California Hastings College of Law and author of the book, White Working Class, Overcoming Class Cluelessness in America. Joan and Tom, before we dive in on this program, we ask our listeners to chime in on the topics. I want you to listen to one of our listeners who responded to us on Facebook when we asked about the intensive media coverage President Trump is getting for his love of McDonald's.
Hi, my name is Khan Ho. I live in mid-city Los Angeles. First of all, I'd like to say I'm not a Trump supporter, but I went to an event called Taste of LA. At the end of the event, I ate a Frito pie, which is basically a Fritos with some chili in it. It was made by a celebrity chef. And two very incredibly drunk white women accosted me and my wife as we were sharing the pie and told us that this was Trump food. It was disgusting. How could we eat it? They probably were talking to us for about, you know, 10 minutes as they harangued us. And it made the entire experience incredibly unpleasant. I knew that we were ideal victims for this kind of verbal assault. We're Asian. We're not going to talk back to you. But I just thought, you know, there's incredible classism that's happening, right? And I wish that people would talk about Trump and his issues and not so much Trump and his habits. We can talk about actually some really important issues, for instance, his policies, the things that he's going to do to the middle class, right? His stances, national and international policy. There's so much to talk about, and I'd rather that we keep it on that tenor. But really, you know, for me, what I found really problematic is that there's a lot of these kind of like aspirational middle class people who don't realize that this kind of rhetoric of like, oh, you're eating at McDonald's, how disgusting, you know, you're eating this kind of Frito pie, how disgusting, this is Trump food. This is actually alienates the very kind of voter that they would actually want to recruit. Right, want to reach out to. It's also small and mean-spirited and very, very begrudging.
Now, Joan, I love that call. I think there's a lot there. What's behind this new twist on the food wars? Why are Americans suddenly attacking each other over what we eat?
Well, it's another example of what I call class cluelessness. I mean, people signal what class they're in by what they choose to eat. And the idea that of going up to somebody and berating them. Now, he said these two people were drunk. They ought to have known better. They clearly didn't. And calling something Trump food is going to be read by Trump supporters as a typical example of the snotty elitism of Trump opponents. And, you know, Khan Ho said it really well when he said, talk about Trump's policies, not his habits. But there's a whole lot of ways in which kind of the blue coasts and elites throughout the country have a whole series of very unselfconscious class insults. I mean, some of the other ones I pointed out are things like flyover states and plumber's butt, and even the caricature of blue-collar men as stupid and fat. You know, think of Homer Simpson. These are very unselfconscious class insults, and they're extremely divisive politically. And my message is, if you want to further empower Trump, be my guest and keep using them.
Now, Tom, you say that Americans need to show more respect for experts. But a lot of experts in nutrition would say that, hey, McDonald's food is not good for you. It's bad for you. Is there any way to say that without sounding condescending and out of touch?
Well, first thing I should say is that I don't represent the Navy or anybody else's views on McDonald's. I think, you know, there's a difference between the kind of thing John talked about, which I think is right. It's class signaling. And I would point out, by the way, that it happens in the other direction. You know, that the way people, I think the way men choose beers sometimes to say this is, you know, a real American beer, or, you know, that this is an up to upscale for me. I think it happens in both directions where people signal their identity by what they're choosing to eat. And this is also, I should, the other thing I kept thinking during Con Ho's comments was this has gone on for a long time. I mean, whether it was George H.W. Bush and pork rinds, or people complaining about the influx of French restaurants when the Reagans came to Washington. I mean, this whole thing about, you know, what you eat is who you are has been going on with presidents and administrations for a long time. The thing with experts and nutrition is to, I don't think people have to take away from a doctor's advice some kind of class message. You know, whether you drink the most expensive Chardonnay or the cheapest beer, every doctor is going to tell you, don't drink a lot. You know, whether you're eating, you know, Kobe beef or, you know, pure Angus burgers or McDonald's, doctors are going to tell you, don't eat too many hamburgers, that, you know, you have to have a varied diet. And I think what's happened in America is that people, it's not that experts tell people that as a way of talking down to them. It's that people's nerves are so far above their skin that they can't hear it any other way. That if someone says, you know, don't eat a lot of fast food, which is just good advice, suddenly people say, well, you're judging me or you're looking down on me. And I think that has more to do with the listener than it does with the speaker.
Now, Joan, do you agree with that? Is it mostly about the listener as opposed to what's being said? Are we just too sensitive?
Well, people, I love the idea of people's nerves are far above their skin. I mean, we have a phenomenon I call sunburn, where people have felt so dissed and disrespected based on their class position that if you just touch them the tiniest amount, they jump a mile. So I do think that's going on. I think expertise, I've been a university professor since I was 20 years old, so I agree with Tom that expertise is very important. I do think that often expertise has been delivered in a class clueless and quite supercilious way. I mean, keep in mind that Patrick Reardon said he went to McDonald's to get some oatmeal. I think that's very healthy breakfast, having just eaten it myself.
Right.
So I think the attack on experts is one of the many prices that we're paying for kind of very unself-conscious, what my parents would call snobism. And I think the solution is not to eliminate expertise, but eliminate the snobism.
Now, Tom, how do you respond to that? Do you think that it's in terms of how we say things? I mean, I'm curious about this. We make lots of choices. We choose what car we're going to drive. For some reason, the idea of what we choose to put in our body is very personal to us. And certainly we get very defensive when people start lecturing us about what we eat. So just specific to this topic, as we wrap up this thread, how do you think we can communicate better and watch what we're saying to one another so as not to come off as elitist?
Well, there's no doubt. I mean, despite my, you know, long defense of experts, that their experts sometimes lack empathy, and they say things that sound factual and obvious to them in a way that sounds condescending to other people. And, you know, the classic example is when you're talking to someone who's out of work and they say, well, the economy's really bad. And an expert, as John would say, totally cluelessly says, oh, no, the economy's really actually quite good. Well, it's not good for that guy. And while you may be right, it's not really a helpful conversation. With that said, I think there's, and J.D. Vance talks about this in his book about growing up in the Midwest, in Hillbilly Elegy, where he talks about reverse snobbery, where people react to smart people or experts instinctively with distrust, because that's not authentic and that's not a real person and that's somebody who's looking down on you. And I think while experts can do better at presenting their advice and being a little more clued into who their audience is, there is this problem in America that authenticity has become, that authenticity and being sort of like the common guy has become the ultimate virtue in public life. And I don't think that's a healthy development, because at some point, you know, if you want to know about going to Mars, you're going to have to ask a NASA scientist and not the guy at the end of the bar.
That's a good point. You know, on the other hand, we sort of have this, we want to have our cake and eat it too. The American voter likes presidents we can relate to. It also wants to look up to its president. And I often feel that we're sending sort of mixed messages to our political class. Do we want them at the end of the bar, or do we want them at the podium? But in any case, I appreciate this discussion. And it's something about the discussion regarding McDonald's and food. It just seems that there's something underlying that in terms of a tendency for Americans to want to feel superior to other Americans. And they're using food as a vehicle to do that. That's very possible. Now, Joan, let me just end with this question to you very quickly. Just have a few minutes left, a couple minutes left before the break. Do you think that there's any way to repair this in terms of does this get worse or better going forward in the Trump administration? This elitism that we're debating, are we only going to get further apart, or can we ever come back together?
Well, I mean, I think there are two things going on. One is the hurt feelings as a result of rampant class cluelessness. And the other is something that's not just hurt feelings. It is the fact that the middle class has been hollowed out, that virtually all Americans born in the 1940s did better than their parents, and now it's kind of a crapshoot. Only fewer than half do better than their parents. So I think what's driving...
Joan, let me get you to hold on for a second. We're going to bring that point right back after the break. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll continue our conversation with Joan Williams and Tom Nichols right after. This is 1 year Later from KCRW. Welcome back. I'm Ruben Navarrete, and this is 1 year Later, presented by Left, Right, and Center. Today, we're talking about elitism with our guests, Tom Nichols, a professor at the Naval War College and author of the book The Death of Expertise, The Campaign Against Established Knowledge and Why It Matters, and Joan Williams, professor at the University of California Hastings School of Law and author of the book White Working Class, Overcoming Class Cluelessness in America. Welcome back to both of you. Now, Tom, you've written before about how Americans are almost at war with expertise and they're skeptical of experts and their expertise. How does this, and this really impacts, and I was struck by this, you said it impacts everything from how patients doubt their doctor's advice to how parents might challenge their kids' teachers. It sort of all seems up for grabs. Where did this trend start?
Well, I would argue that it actually is probably goes back at least 40 or 50 years, but that skepticism about eggheads and intellectuals is a part of American culture, and it's probably a pretty good part of American culture for most of our history, that we didn't automatically defer to people of different educational classes. You know, we always made an icon of the, you know, log cabin presidents who were self-educated and, you know, had wisdom rather than just book smarts. But I think something's changed. I think that the American public has become vastly more narcissistic, intolerant of being contradicted, wrapped in our own bubbles, whether coastal or heartland or, you know, educational or occupational. And we really are not good at taking even well-intentioned advice because we've all been taught, you know, from childhood that our feelings are the most important thing in the world. And I think that contributes to this. And I think the other, what's also changed in a much more recent way is the conflation of the word expert with the word elite. And I think that has really become pernicious because experts are sometimes elites and elites are sometimes experts, but they're not always the same. There are plenty of, you know, fantastically wealthy people out there who are not particular experts. And there are a lot of good experts, including in your own community, whether they're electricians or doctors or the people who, you know, delivering your mail, who know about the Postal Service, who are experts, but they are certainly not elites. And I think people have conflated these in their head so that anytime anyone says, well, I'm an expert, or I know about, I'm smart about this issue, what people hear, again, and that Joan calls it sunburn, and I call it your nerves being far outside your skin, what people hear is, you think you're better than I am. You think you're, because you know something more than I do, you think you're better than me and you're putting me down.
Now, Joan, I asked you before the break about the division and whether it's ever going to get any better or does it only get worse in terms of now how Americans are attacking one another based on, and there's a kind of a Trump factor to this. I want you to continue that point that you were making, also respond to what Tom just said in terms of how this is playing out in our daily interactions.
Well, I think what's poisoning American politics, I mean, we've always have had these class divisions, but what's poisonous now is that so many people see the American dream slipping out of their reach. We've had a real decrease in wages. I mean, wages used to rise when productivity did, and if that had continued, wages would be double what they are today. So people see middle-class life slipping away from their grasp, and that's, I think that's what's gotten them so deeply upset, and that's why all of these class divisions have taken on such an incredibly powerful and bitter edge. And I think that Tom makes a really good point that one of the many fatalities of that bitter edge being driven by economic anxiety is the ability to listen calmly to experts. I do think experts often condescend, but Tom is very, very right. I mean, I can't fix a light. I don't know if you can. There's an expert for you. There are some people who have areas of expertise, and we should listen to them.
So, John, I want to follow up, just if I could. You've written before about how you think a lot of Trump's appeal to working-class Americans has to do with the resentment that they feel toward these smug professionals who they are close to in proximity, they're rubbing up against every day. And they feel these folks tell them what to think and now who to vote for. My question, though, is how did Trump, who's a super rich billionaire, become a vehicle for this resentment?
I think Trump is a perfect channel for their resentment of elites. And the reason, even though he's, you know, a rich boy who started out with a tiny little multi-million dollar loan from his daddy, he feels the same resentment against the elites because Trump is a boy from Queens who has always been looked down on by the equally rich people in Manhattan. And so I think that's why Trump is so incredibly adept at channeling this resentment. And although, you know, he's a pretty limited guy in a lot of ways, he's really high in the ability to connect with people around anger and resentment.
So, Tom, I wanted to, I'm going to get both of you to talk a little bit more about your work coming up to this point on background and some of the books, some of the theories in your books and themes in your books. But something, Tom, that Joan just said about this skill of being able to relate to people, this is no small thing. I mean, this is a whole different kind of expertise when you're able to connect with people. Bill Clinton did it incredibly well. Hillary Clinton, not so much, I'd argue. Now you have Donald Trump doing it. My question is it possible to be an expert, to have something to say without being an elitist that turns off people so no one listens to you?
Well, some of that is just at the level of gut reaction. And I wanted to raise a point here because I think, you know, Joan's point is somewhat self-contradictory, because what it really means, on the one hand, we talk about economic anxiety, and yet we talk about the admiration of the president for being a successful rich guy. And I think I don't want to misattribute this quote, but I think it was Fran Lebowitz who said, when America talks about hating elites, they don't hate rich people. America loves rich people. They hate smart people. And this is, I think, a part of the root problem, because we're talking about that. There's no doubt that, you know, buying a house and finding a good job in the manufacturing sector, all those things that we thought of as the American dream in the 1960s, is harder for people to attain. On the other hand, I'm always struck when I'm talking to much younger people that they are completely unaware of the huge gap in living standards between a middle-class family in 1965 and someone who's even struggling in 2017. in terms of just the sheer material comfort of the standard of living around them. I'm really allergic to the economic anxiety argument because I've seen people, just as Joan points out about the president, you know, despite how wealthy he is, still carrying that sense of resentment. I've seen that same sense of resentment, you know, where I live, from people living in $500,000 houses. I don't think it's economic. I think it has to do with moving into the information age, where people resent others who have successfully moved into the information age, who are more adept at manipulating information and understanding the modern world we live in. I think the expertise in terms of connecting with that resentful class is really, it's something that's instinctive for most of these people. I mean, Bill Clinton maybe put more thought into it. You know, he was a Rhodes Scholar, and he somehow managed to never mention that when he was on the road. I think
right, that was
Trump,
notable.
As an entertainer,
yeah,
you know, has really had that ability. But
Joan,
I still think this is not about economics.
Thank you, Tom. Joan, I want to give you a chance to respond to what Tom said. He said your point was self-contradictory. Point that out to me. How do you respond to that? And ultimately, this question that still nags at me about how class and financial resources and elitism all overlap with one another.
Well, I mean, there are 40 years of studies that show that the white working class resents professionals but admires the rich. And they resent professionals partly because of the condescension we've been talking about, but also because professionals are really different culturally than the white working class. Professionals are attracted to the edgy, the disruption, the artisanal, and the white working class is attracted to the tried and true and the traditional. And so they don't want to change their culture and be stigmatized by those around them. They don't want to be professionals, but what they want is their own lives just with more money. And that's the fantasy that Donald Trump represents to them.
So we should mention that the whole theme of our show, 1 year later, talks about this being the 1 year since the Trump election and how and looking at how America's changed. I want you to each talk about your books, and given that your works came out largely in response to Trump's victory, if I'm not mistaken, what advice would you give to Democrats? I'll put this question to both of you. What advice would you give to Democrats, others who are never Trump, who want to win back some of those working class voters that somehow found their way to the president? So I'll start with you, Joan.
Well,
I'm sorry. Let me go to Joan first.
Sure. Okay. Well, I mean, in fact, I've spent a lot of time talking to Democrats about exactly that issue, and I think the answer is very simple. Number one, stop insulting people, either for whether they eat McDonald's or what music they like, and realize that elite folkways are folkways, just as white working class folkways are folkways. They're just two different ways of doing things. And the second is hear people's anxiety about losing the American dream and focus on jobs, jobs, jobs. That's what has taken the Republican Party where it is today. They have a perfect explanation. Why did the jobs leave? Trade treaties. Why are the ones that we have low-paid? Immigrants. What's the solution? Huge tax cut for the job creators. You know, if you don't like that story, Democrats are going to have to offer a different one that's equally easy to telegraph.
Now, Tom, let me end the final question to you. Same question. What's your advice for Democrats, others who are never Trump, who want to win back some of those working class voters that have been turned off?
Well, the first thing I should say is that I actually didn't write the book in response to the election. It came out at the election time, and it was just a kind of synergistic connection there. But I started a few years beforehand. And I think the one thing I've thought about in that year since is that you know, the president ran against experts. I mean, he said point blank, we don't need them, they're terrible. And I guess my question is, how's that been working out in practice, trying to run, you know, a superpower without experts? And I would say it's probably not going very well. My nonpartisan advice for both parties is to get away from their fringes. And I think the Democrats have been have lost some opportunities there. I think Joan's absolutely right that for voters from both sides, you know, jobs and kind of kitchen table issues are dominant, and yet the parties now have become really in their public personas fringy, and that's okay for the Republicans. Their voters are a different group. I mean, they're right now that's kind of running a big part of their politics, but I don't think that that's going to pull people into the in with the Democrats because they need to poach their votes out of the middle. And I think, you know, running hard to the left, as I think some Democrats have argued they should do, isn't going to work.
You've both given us a lot to think about in terms of going forward, and I appreciate your work reading through it and having you here on as our guest. I want to think about, for a second, before we close out this segment, the sort of human need about, and I'll just leave with this, human need to sort of feel different from one another, and whether or not this is driving some of that elitism. I take Joan's point that a good first place to start is to stop insulting one another. And I'm always wondering what it is that drives us to feel that we need to differentiate ourselves from one another. Left to have to end it there. Thanks to my guests, Joan Williams, who's author of The White Working Class, Overcoming Class Cluelessness in America, and professor of law at the College of Law at Hastings, and Tom Nichols, who wrote The Death of Expertise, The Campaign Against Established Knowledge and Why It Matters. We'll take a short break, and after that, we're going to talk it out. We'll talk about the Me Too movement at edges closer to the White House, day by day, when we continue with 1 year later from KCRW. I'm Ruben Navarrete, back with 1 year later, produced by Left, Right, and Center. This is the part of the show where you talk it out. We talk through the big political stories of the day with two political viewpoints. Since I'm representing the center, we're bringing in Ed Kilgore, our liberal voice today. He's a political columnist at New York Magazine. Hi, Ed.
Hi, I'm Ruben.
So, topic number one, this story about President Trump and the women who've come forward to accuse him of sexual harassment. The Me Too movement is edging closer to the White House. President Trump has already been getting, had been getting a lot of attention from women who yesterday renewed their allegations of harassment against the president. In a suggestive tweet today, he said that New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand would do anything for money. What is Trump up to? He somehow has managed to be excluded. He had managed up to now to be excluded from the Me Too conversation. I'm not sure how, but now he's smack dab in the middle of it again. This can't be good, right?
Probably not, though. You know, it's like everything else this president does. I'm shocked but not surprised. I don't think he can avoid the Me Too moment perpetually. I mean, after all, the allegations surrounding him, if applied to, say, a United States senator or a member of the House, would have them in very deep trouble, if not in danger of being pushed to resign. So it's just unavoidable that the President of the United States recently suffered from, was exposed to similar allegations. So I guess he's decided to push back. Some have even said that he's trying to trigger a backlash to the whole, you know, Me Too movement.
Now, the reaction from Gillibrand was swift. She called it a sexist smear. She also, again, called for congressional investigations into these claims made by women against Trump. Is any of this going to amount to a problem for the White House, or has it just become immune to these kinds of charges?
It could be a problem for the White House. I mean, I obviously, the president's trying to insulate himself with his base from any kind of allegations. What he may have actually accomplished is to elevate Senator Gillibrand on the list of Democrats who might run for president in 2020. Being personally insulted by the president is something of a badge of honor for elected Democrats.
I also wonder whether or not he's already lost certain people. He never had them in the first place, but those who like him, they don't seem to be moved by this. I wonder if there's any movement at all. I always wonder whether there are folks who supported Trump who might take a different look at him because of these allegations. Do you see any evidence of that?
I don't see any evidence of that just yet. But I don't know. I mean, there was a Morning Consult poll just last week that actually the president was touting because it gave him a pretty high, well, relatively high approval rating of about 45%. And it showed that a majority of respondents found the allegations against the president credible. That can't be very good news. So there may even be people who voted for him who, in this very different context, as you suggest, may be rethinking it.
Now, Ed, you said something really interesting about how he may be trying to provoke a backlash against the Me Too movement. And some would say he did this with patriotism and the kneeling at NFL games. That maybe the public will turn out to be on his side, or at least some portion of it. Do you expect that this will work, or is this a dangerous strategy? It seems like he's playing with fire.
Oh, he is playing with fire, but I think he does that all the time. I think, who knows what this man is, you know, what really makes him tick, but, you know, he's certainly, it's very clear that he believes that his own political base requires constant stoking through provocative statements and identification of enemies. I mean, the, you know, the new 280-character Twitter limit does mean that he can get twice as many insults in each tweet, and I think he's taking full advantage of that.
That's right. The Me Too movement has had an unexpected sense of power and resiliency, I got to say it. Can Trump keep doing what he's doing? His strategy up to this point just seems to be deny, deny. Not only did I not do this to this woman, I've never even met the woman. Is that working? Is this strategy really working for the president?
That is not going to work because it's too easily falsifiable. And, of course, he's willing to deny his denials for that matter. But, I really think the attitude within the White House is exactly what White House spokesperson Sarah Huckabee Sanders said the other day, that the American people judge that by electing him president, which is a very strange way of looking at, swirling allegations that are based on, you know, facts, not the opinions of the electorate. So I think they may be underestimating the threat.
I'm here with Ed Kilgore, who's political columnist at New York Magazine. Ed, I want to switch gears and talk about Alabama. Now, today, Alabamians are headed to the polls. The race there, the Senate race that could not, we thought, get any uglier, turns out yesterday got even uglier in the campaign for the Senate seat. Here's Kyla Moore, Roy Moore's wife, speaking last night.
We have many friends that are black, and we also fellowship with them in church and in our home.
That's right.
Fake news would tell you that we don't care for Jews. I tell you all this because I've seen it all, so I just want to set the record straight while they're here. One of our attorneys is a Jew.
Now, Ed, that seemed to come out of left field. You know the old classic line, some of my best friends are African-American, or some of my best friends are Latino. This sounded just like that. Why did Mrs. Moore even bring up the subject of Jews? Had there been charges of anti-Semitism during the campaign?
Lord knows, I haven't heard. I've read a lot about this race, but I hadn't heard any allegations of anti-Semitism whatsoever. So who knows? I think we did get a good indication last night in general why the candidate and his immediate circle have been scarce on the ground in the run-up to this election. They have everything to lose and very little to gain by putting the judge and apparently his wife out there in public to make mistakes.
You know, Ed, it's also the case that those of us who are looking outside, we don't live in Alabama, we're not voting in Alabama. But when I see the crowd reaction to that kind of comment about the lawyer, it doesn't seem that there's an outrage there the way that it seems to be not so playing so well in other places. So I guess we've got to be careful with the geography of it, right? It's very possible that what you and I are shocked by doesn't shock folks in Alabama.
Well, you may notice from my accent that I have been in very similar places a good part of my life. I don't think it's geography so much as it is ideology. Judge Moore has got a hard kernel of support of people that have been supporting him and voting for him dating back to the year 2000 when he was first ran statewide. They will vote for him no matter what. They will cheer him no matter what he says. It's an ineradicable vote. The question is what happens with the rest of the electorate. The early indications today from Alabama show higher than average turnout, particularly in the cities. I'm not going to make a prediction, but it's certainly possible we're going to have a shocker tonight.
You know, I could really see this going both ways, either way. I've looked at this race carefully for the last few days or so, a few weeks. It keeps going back and forth. Betting sites, as you may know, don't give Jones that much of a chance. But on the ground, Jones and some of his supporters, they seem pretty confident. I'm not sure how this will turn out.
It's absolutely impossible well in advance to figure out who's going to turn out in a special election less than 2 weeks before Christmas, with one of the two major candidates being so controversial a figure. And he was controversial, by the way, before the sexual allegations arose. He is, you know, America's favorite theocrat. He's been very, very plain about that all along. And there are Republicans in Alabama that really don't want to vote for him, even if they don't believe the sexual allegations. So it's a very difficult race to predict.
Now, you've made a very good point. You've said before, whether they win or lose, Republicans are going to have a headache on their hands, thanks to Roy Boren in the Senate race. Now, I'm curious, what is likely to cause for Republicans in Washington the bigger headache, if Moore wins or if Moore loses?
Well, probably the bigger headache would be Moore losing, simply because this, well, first of all, it could even create some complications for year-end legislation and even the tax bill if there's a Democratic senator in place. It also opens up a much clearer path for Democratic control of the Senate in 2018 if this heavily Republican state has a Democratic senator. But, you know, Roy Moore's not going to be a treat either. A very large number of Republican senators have already called for ethics investigations of the allegations against Moore, if not expulsion from the Senate. All of this is going to tie the Republican Party to, you know, an alleged sexual predator at the worst possible moment in American history for that kind of association. So it's very, very tricky for Republicans if Roy Moore joins their conference. In fact, there's talk that he may be denied committee assignments for months and months and months. And it's just a bad scene.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, the funny thing is we talk so much about how Republicans in Washington are going to react to Roy Moore. We probably need to talk more about how Roy Moore's going to react to Republicans in Washington. And clearly, I think he's going to go in with a sense of having a grudge, perhaps, against some of those other Senate colleagues who've come out against him, sometimes very vocally. How do you see that part of the story playing out? Is it likely that Roy Moore will show up not eager to play nice with his fellow Republicans?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, from the very beginning of this whole campaign, he's called for Mitch McConnell to step down as you know, Senate Majority Leader. He's got to be aware that a significant number of his future would-be colleagues have distanced themselves from him or even said they want to expel him the minute he's seated. And anybody that's been around Roy Moore or observed him over the years is, you know, he is a very black and white, judgmental sort of guy, and I can't imagine him playing pretty with other Republicans in the Senate.
Ed, one final question.
And a fortune trying to beat him.
Ed, one final question. You know, this is Alabama. It's had a long history of concerns about voting access for certain voters,
yes.
African Americans in particular. Do you know of any concerns in this particular race about that? Has that issue been brought up, and is that something we should be watching as well?
Well, the whole environment in Alabama is not very good for access to the ballot. There are virtually no early voting opportunities. It's one of these states where you have to sign an oath that you can't vote on election day to vote absentee. It's not that, you know, it's a voter ID state. It's, you know, there are a lot of things about it that discourage African-American participation. I haven't heard of any, you know, downright abuses yet, but it is important to understand that the state election machinery and machinery in most counties is in the hands of Republicans, so it bears watching.
Thanks so much. That's Ed Kilgore, who's political columnist at New York Magazine. Thanks, Ed, for joining us.
Thank you.
That's it for today on 1 Year Later. Meet us back here tomorrow for our show on what's happening to public lands in the Trump era. Today's last note is one of my favorites, Bruce Springsteen's Youngstown. 1 Year Later is a co-production of KCRW Los Angeles and Public Radio International. Always the same. 700 tons in the middle of the day. Now, sir, you tell me the world's changed. Once I made you rich enough to forget my name. In Youngstown. In Youngstown. My sweet Jenny, I'm sinking down here, darling, in Youngstown. When I die, I don't want no part of heaven. I would not do heaven's work well. I pray the devil comes and takes me to stand in the fiery furnaces of hell.
PRI. Public Radio National.